Gene, I think we should go into one thing that a lot of people are completely unfamiliar with. I mean, they, you know, some people have been listening to you maybe for 2, 3, 5 years, but a lot of people don't know about iLibertine, and I'd like to have you rehash that story. We've never done it on the air.
No, I don't think
we've never had, and that is a great story. Are you familiar with the iLibertine story?
I have to be refreshed. I don't
know. Well, do it. Gene, tell us how the whole thing started.
That's quite a story. I,
Mark.
This is very strange. It was a progression of peculiar events that led to an international, in fact, a worldwide story. I'm surprised you don't remember it. Maybe you will remember it when you're refreshed on it. But when I first came to New York, Bob, I was on all night on WOR. I was on late at night. I was broadcasting from the transmitter at WOR.
Not in Carteret.
Yeah, and in those days, this really was a turning point in radio, although at the time nobody really knew it. In those days, radio was a very, very formatized form of entertainment. It was format all the way down the line. And the formats, there were disc jockeys, and they had a stranglehold on the industry. And radio really was an adjunct of the music business. And then there were a few newscasters on, and that was about the extent of it. And I had come out of the Midwest, and I had an idea that radio as a personal form of communication, a personal artistic medium, in other words, to use radio to say things and to do things which have a very personal meaning for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not plugging Pat Boone's records or interviewing some lady who draws pictures on velvet cats. I used radio the same way that a writer uses a sheet of paper to say what he has to say about the world. Well, this was very peculiar. It's not really been done, and I was on late at night, and the time was a very peculiar time. It was during the time of Eisenhower, and there was it was the beginning, the very beginnings of what later became known as the black comedy period in America. Satire was unknown. There was a lot of comedy. Today we call comedy satire. There is really still very little satire around. Most people today call a comic a satirist. Not so. And also, I don't consider a man who does political gags a satirist. That's often called a satirist. Mm-hmm. He's really just a polemicist. But I'm on late at night, and I'm doing this stuff and working away 7 days a week, and it was hot. It was the middle of summer. And I was new in New York, and I suddenly became aware that New York is almost entirely a city that really does run on lists. The first time I really ran into, the hit syndrome, that if Brooks Atkinson, who was writing in those days, said a show was a hit, it was a hit.
Mm-hmm.
If he said it was good, even if the people who went to see it fell asleep. And they thought they were failing Brooks Atkinson. I was fascinated by this, you see. And in New York, the 10 best dressed people are talked about on the radio all over New York and television. And they don't even think about this in Cleveland or Cincinnati. It's a New York phenomenon. And it just began to interest me. And one night, late at night, I'm on the air, and I said, you know, has it ever occurred to you, friends, that these lists are compiled by mortals, and that they are human just like you are, and in fact, they have many more access to grain than you. Now, we all laugh at, say, the Academy Awards. Have you ever been asked to vote on the best movie? All we do is sit and somebody hands somebody else a statue, and that's the best movie of the year. And I said, is it really? Is it really?
You're not supposed to think that way.
I know it. And I'm doing this stuff late at night. And I says, now I'll carry it even further. I said, no matter who you are in New York, you're influenced by these lists. I says, you may laugh at the one that's in the Daily News because you read the Times. And somehow, if it says the top 10 bestsellers in the New York Times, you really do think. You may never have even seen a copy of those bestsellers. But because it's in the Times, it's authentic. I said, has it occurred to you that there's a little guy who is bugged because for 4 years he was on obituaries and he's always had this dream of being Walter Lippmann, 17 years, and now he's got this desk, and all he does every Monday is call these little schlock book dealers around town and says, "How what's selling this week, man?" And I says, "Now let's take it even further. You'll read this little thing at the bottom." He says, "This is a list that is made up of, let's say, 422 authentic books that you deal." I said, "Well, let's go back to the book dealer." And so we go into the bookstore, and here's this guy, this Fred Applerod, he's the book buyer, see, and he bought 500 copies of Who Shot John?
Yes.
3 months ago, and he's got 497 of them.
Yes.
So,
boy, they're going.
Yeah, so he says to Mr. So-and-so who calls, "Why, Who Shot John is moving here, I'll tell you, there's nothing like it." I said, four or five other guys say the same thing, and the next thing you know, Who Shot John is number four.
Yes.
And all the people who believe in lists rush out like mad and buy it. And then it becomes an authentic.
This is so true.
Of course
sure.
It's true. Yeah. Well, people were calling up, and they said, "This is ridiculous. How can this be? What do you mean? You know, this is an authentic list." And I says, "All right, I'll tell you what let's do, friend." And this is 3 o'clock in the morning. I says, "Now, the people who believe in lists are asleep." I says, "Because they get up at 7 o'clock, bright and bushy-tailed, to run down to the agency. They buy all the hit show tickets.
Yeah.
You know, they really love Barbra Streisand and all this." And I said, "And anybody who's sitting up here at 3 o'clock in the morning secretly has doubts." I mean, because a lot of us still got to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning. And while you're sitting here at 3 o'clock in the morning listening to me, I says, "There's only two kinds of people, us and them. And they don't know we exist."
We're back again. Back to the story of High Liberty.
You really want to hear this?
Oh, it's so great, honestly.
Because I don't like to take over the microphone here. We're all sitting around kidding around tonight. But that story taught me a lesson, Bob, that I'll never forget. Dick, it taught a lot of people a lesson. Because I was just sitting here talking about things. You know, it was a theoretical thing. Now, remember, this is 10 years ago when people did, they accepted things like bestseller lists as actually authentic. The top 40 tunes to a person listening, he says, that must be the top 40. And I had learned a lesson earlier on that. I remember a guy once in Cincinnati who by public relations, one thing and another, he had a record on the top 30 tunes in the, quote, Bible of Showbiz before it was even published. It had never even been published. Here it was number 8. So all the disc jockeys across the country, you see, would get this Bible and say, "Well, it must be big in Pittsburgh. I haven't gotten my copy yet." Well, sure enough, when they turned it out, every DJ in the country played played the pants off this record because it was number 3 and number 6, and then it became number 1 authentically. Well, the public, I guess, is not aware of the chicanery that goes into these lists and what they do mean to books and they mean to films, one thing or another. There's millions riding on that, and you and I all know that when millions are riding on things, that's when the operations get big. So I'm doing this thing late at night. And that was simultaneously, Bob, at the time that I created a term. You know, it's kind of an eerie feeling to have created a term that has entered the language. Now, you know, you read terms like hot diggity dog. Can you imagine the guy that first said that?
Yeah, whack-a-ding-hoy.
Well, no, I mean the one who first said it. He created something that has entered the language, like... oh, gosh, somebody must have said that the first time. Well, I actually created a term that you see on billboards, you read it in paid papers all the time, and it came about on that show. This is 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, "Look," and it just hit me out of the blue. I said, "You know, there's two kinds of people. I've just been thinking about this, really. There's the kind of guy who believes in the world of the office. He really believes in file cabinets. He believes in luncheons. He believes that the day, the time from 8 a.m. to 6 in the evening is the time he's alive. The phone call, the lunch, the appointment. And the time after that
is just dead time. He flops down in front of the TV set. He drinks his beer. He goes to sleep.
Just waiting for the next day.
I said, now that is a day person. His world is the day world. But there's the other guy whose world begins the minute he gets out of that office. And his time is at 4 o'clock in the morning, 2 in the morning. He's his own private world. He's a night person. That's, I created the term night person, and you'll find it in the American Dictionary of Slang and Usage, and they credit me with it. And I said, and of course, the opposite number is the day person, and they're constantly battling, only they don't know that they are. So you're sitting in this sales meeting, and here is this guy sitting over here, and he's got this light of ecclesiastical fervor. He believes in Operation Dynamo that you're about to foist on the public. He believes in it. See, and you're sitting there all...
William McCormick.
Yeah, that's right, Bill McCormick. And you're sitting over there, is this guy serious? He really believes in it? And you try to make a funny with him. He says, well, you know, remember what happened to Operation Over the Top? And he looks at you. You know. Well, of course, if it hadn't been for Fred and accounting, that would have gone over. Well, there's the battle, you see, going on. And I said, now let's face it, it's the day people who buy lists. They are statistically oriented, and they will not go to a hit show unless there is a line of over 100 in front of that box office. I mean, it could be the worst turkey in the world. If they read in the paper it costs $20 to get a ticket, that's better than a $1 ticket. They're oriented to money. A $5,000 car must be five times better than a $1,000 car, even if the transmission is made out of balsa wood. It's got to be better. Now, that's the statistical mind, and he is the day man. So I said, now, if you think I'm kidding, I said, I'll tell you what. I said, the day man is not listening to us. He can't he thinks we're nuts. He says, he's listening to me, and he says, what's this nut talking about? And he goes off, and he gets WPAT on, you know, with that nice Mondovani record, you know, this the opiate for the masses, see? And I said, I'll tell you what let's do. I says, if you think I'm kidding, I said, what do you say tomorrow morning, each one of us, walk into a bookstore and ask for a book that we know does not exist? We're going to create it here. It does not exist. Walk into a bookstore and ask for a book that we know does not exist. We're going to create it here. It does not exist. Let's just see what happens. Because the day man will believe that it is. And let's see how it works. I said, now look, since we're all in this together, what do you say now? We're going to make this a communal affair. And I'm not... You give me a suggestion for a title. Just call it in. And millions of calls. They were coming from, you know, at night, the 50,000-watt station at 4 in the morning. I'm getting calls from Alaska. And these guys are giving me all these suggestions for titles. And finally, at 4:30 in the morning, it was getting so late, I had to go off at 5:30. I said, okay, it's closed. I picked the title. And some unknown guy called in this title, I, Libertine. I said, now that sounds like a book. I mean, it could be almost anything. I, comma, Libertine. I said, now, I'm going to create... you got to have an author. Because today, you know, most people, you know, they say, if you read the newest Faulkner, Jacqueline Suzanne's a big deal, you know. You've got to have an author. All right, I'll create an author. And I sat for a minute, and it just hit me, the name. I says, okay, the author's name is Frederick Ewing. Frederick Roland Ewing. He's British. He was a lieutenant commander in World War II on the North Atlantic, the Murmansk Run. He is now a civil servant in Rhodesia. He is married to Marjorie, a horsewoman from the North Country. He writes extensively for The Observer, and he is known primarily for his pre-World War II broadcast on the third program of the BBC, 18th Century Erotica. And he's a scholar, and I, Libertine is the first volume of a trilogy on 18th century English court life. And by the way, Mr. Ewing is quite surprised at the success his book is enjoying, since it was written primarily for scholars. He hopes people do not misunderstand certain chapters that are there for the purpose of scholarly research. And I said, just go in and say, I would like Ewing's I, Libertine. I says, and if anybody asks you, it was printed by Excelsior Press,
yeah,
which, by the way, is a subsidiary of Cambridge University Imprint. I said, there is not a bookseller in the country that can argue with Cambridge. And a British author who's married to a lady named Marjorie. I says, now you go in and don't crack a smile. Don't do anything. And when the man says to you, the first thing, I says, he's also bound by lists. The first thing he'll do, you'll walk in and say, I would like to have a copy of I, Libertine by Frederick Ewing. And he'll say, who published it? You say, Excelsior Press. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, of course. Yes. Just a moment. And he'll take out a list, and he'll look it up, and he'll see that it is not listed. He will turn to you and say, there's no such book. He said, well, I'll go to Doubleday's then, and leave. Well, the next guy that comes in and asks for this, he'll say, it's on order. And the third one that comes in, he's going to be on his phone calling the distributor.
Yeah.
And the distributor's going to say to him, you're out of your bird, Fred. You're being put on. There's no such book. I've got the big list here. And there's nothing like that. Well, if 422 bookstores call in, he's going to be calling Publishers Weekly. And within 20 minutes, Publishers Weekly has collapsed in a pile of rubble. And remember, it's a $6.95 book. They don't laugh at a $7 book. I says, now get out and go, and we'll sit back and see what happens. Now, remember, every listener knew that book did not exist. And
yeah,
they knew it didn't exist.
Right.
I says, now remember, it does not exist. You know this, and let's see what happens. And I says, you let me know tomorrow morning and the day after that. Give me reports, and I will give them out to the listeners what's happening. Sure enough, the next day, a guy says, you know, he says, For years, this guy in this A Street bookstore with this beard has had me totally buffaloed. I mean, he stands back of that cash register, and you have a feeling that he wrote Kierkegaard. That he was behind Schopenhauer when Schopenhauer wrote this stuff. And he says, you know, he used to say things like this. I'd go in and I'd say, there's something about Marcel Proust. And he says, well, of course, Proust never matured. And he says, you know, I went in there today, and I said to this guy, I'd like a copy of I, Libertine by Ewing. And he says, he looked up from behind the cash register and said, Ewing, it's about time the public discovered him. He says, the scales fell from my eyes. He says, I learned something. And I'm getting these calls from people up. One woman wrote in, and she, 2 days later, she says she was sitting in her bridge party. And she just casually mentioned, gee, I've been reading I, Libertine. And three ladies started to discuss it. They not only had read it, they finished it, and two of them didn't like it. And so she says, it was all that. She says, then I got a letter from a kid at 2 weeks later. They're coming in from all over the country saying, what's happening is that people are hearing this, you know, airline pilots were listening. It was spreading to Paris, Rome, Japip, every place else. And a guy wrote me a letter. He says, Shepard, he says, don't say anything about this. He says, look at this. And he enclosed in this envelope, he says, I'm a student at a university, which I shall not name. It's in Jersey. I'll pick a pen name. Let's think of some funny name. Rutgers. He was a student at this non-existent school called Rutgers thing. And he says, I'm in this English, this history of English writing course. And he said, I wrote a term paper on F.R. Ewing, Eclectic Historian. And it was about a 9-page paper with footnotes, quotes from Ewing's earlier BBC broadcast, references. And the thing, he sent it to me, and it had a big red thing on the front of it. It said, superb research. He got a B plus.
Always a B plus.
Yeah.
Never an
A. And the guy, says, what? He says, my whole education is probably phony. He says, oh, but there wasn't even a Chaucer. You know, this could have been some guy 400 years ago, putting the whole world on. So all of it, and I says, wait, let's sit back. I says, don't say anything. Just keep asking. Well, do you know, within 4 weeks, there was a piece appeared in the Earl Wilson column. It said, had lunch with Freddie Ewing. On his way to India with his wife Marjorie.
Oh, no.
I'm not kidding you. You know, and I begin to get frightened, because It's like a guy who stands at the base of a mountain, and he says to himself, gee, I wonder what would happen if I threw a pebble up there. And he throws one up there, and the next thing you know, he's got a 420 trillion ton avalanche coming down on him. You know, it's just incredible. This thing pyramided. And so I began to get all over. Do you know that at the end of the sixth week, one of the funniest things that happened, that one of the book supplements, at that time there were three book supplements published with Sunday newspapers in New York. There was the New York Times book supplement, and there were two others. One of the book supplements had a review of I, Libertine.
Now, how could that have happened?
Well, now, here's what I said. Now, wait a minute. Now, that goes into later. Now, this is the truth. I've got it all in clippings.
I know it's the truth.
Now,
how
it happened was my listeners all over the place, even book reviewers, were foisting it on people.
Oh.
They were calling up editors, I'd like to review this new book. And listeners were beginning to throw their... And I says, any place you can throw your little hooker in, let's do it and see what happens. So some PR man wrote to one of the columnists, and next thing you know, they're having lunch with Freddie Ewing's. Well, these comments about Ewing began to appear all over in the newspapers. And the final upshot of it all was, I'm getting letters from people. I says, you know, the other day my boss asked me if I read it. He says, what do I say? So my boss reads all the book club books. And he's waiting for it to come in the book club, you know. And the boss, he says, all this stuff. And one day, the final one, it scared me. I, Libertine, was on the proscribed list. It was banned by a very prominent church.
I was going to remain nameless.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, I didn't know.
By the
Boston
Diocese. No, this blew the gap. I said, and my listeners are staggering. You know, and what do you think? At the end of the seventh week, it is on a nationwide bestseller list.
But, Gene, just to interject one, do you mean that it's possible that several hundred
people... I'm telling you what happened.
Yeah, but 700 people then could have been excommunicated for reading the book.
That's right. Let me then see, you're killing the story, but that I'm telling you what happened. This is not a thing for gags. This is just exactly a historical thing. And I'm sitting back there, and all this stuff is happening, see. And about, I'd say, 2 o'clock on a Wednesday or Thursday morning, and this has been going for 8 weeks now, that it is now a bestseller in Paris, in Rome. They're asking for it in bookstores. They're asking for it in places like Honolulu, everywhere, all over. And the people who are asking for it, remember, know that it doesn't exist. That's the important point.
Right.
They are sitting back and watching the repercussions. And here it is, you know, there's no mentions of the book in all kinds of columns and everywhere of people who think it does exist. I says, remember, friends, they think it does. And when we were banned in Boston by a very prominent church, I mean, our whole world was crumbling. You see, I mean, by now I was a little afraid, you know, next thing you know, the president's going to mention it, you know, that he loves this book. See, then I wouldn't believe in anything, you know. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, I get a telephone call, and this guy gets on the phone, very funny voice, and he says, look, he says, Shep, he says, you know, you're right. You've touched on something very important. There are two kinds of people in this country, the believers and us. And he said, I am a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And he says, I've listened to this thing from the beginning. He says, it's incredible. And by the way, we had even had an editorial in Life. And he said, this is fantastic. And he says, don't you think it's about time to spill the story? And I said, yeah, I think so. I said, this is getting out of hand. And so he came down to the office, and I showed him all this documentary proof. And he went back to his office, and he worked on this piece. And on Wednesday afternoon, on this August, hot August day, it appeared front page, middle, 2-3-column banner. It says, gigantic literary hoax shows the real phoniness behind a lot of the things that people believe in, like lists and so on. And he had the whole thing documented. Well, that came out on the newsstands at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was sitting in my office. It was fantastic. At 3:01, I would say with it between 301 and 305, there were six countries on the phone calling me about that. Melbourne was calling. Rome was calling. Newspaper editors, Figaro, the German newspapers, everywhere. It was a fantastic story. And that story, it's probably one of the very few stories that has ever been printed, word for word, taken out of the Wall Street Journal and reprinted in Pravda. It was printed exactly word for word. Well, this thing just blew to the point where people were calling from all over. And then, it was never, at any point, was there any PR involved. It was a whole series of forces that came together. And I think that time, that particular year, was the beginning of the whole new attitude that people have today towards things which they never questioned. People today question politicians. They never did, really. They used to say things about it, but today they really question. People look at things, and it was the beginning, and I'm not saying that started it. I'm saying that was the beginning of a whole thing. After that, Mort Saul grew, and Lenny Bruce, and the whole thing changed over almost in that period overnight. It just began to mushroom.
Isn't there more to that story about the book?
Oh, there's much more, but we don't have that time.
Am I crazy, or did I read that somebody eventually wrote a book?
No, later then. You see, when it was finally,
later on about
you
a.
See,
you know.
you're going ahead again. Then, one day, a friend of mine, a writer, Ted Sturgeon called me one day and said, "Listen," he says, "you know," he says, "there's this publisher, who he says he's a paperback publisher, and he says you have got him taken." He said, "This guy is going around all over the world trying to get the paperback reprints rights on I Liberty." And so he says, "Let's have lunch with him," and he says, "Let's have kick." So I sat down with him. And he says, we were eating lunch, and he turns to him, and he said, "Listen," he said, "would you like to meet..." The publisher was Ian Ballantyne. Ballantyne, he said, "would you like to meet I Liberty? Would you like to meet Fred Ewing?" And Ian is a very innocent type guy. He says, "Yeah," he says, "I certainly would." He says, "I'd be very interested in meeting him." And he says, "Well, here he is, sitting right here."
Hmm.
And that lunch, we decided, he says, "Well, let's turn out I Liberty, and all the day people will buy it. The night people will not." We find it, and we turned all the we took all the profits of the thing, by the way, and turned it over to charity, in case you're interested.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, it was not a commercial deal in any sense of the word. So we put this baby on, and sure enough, we're together. He and I, we banged this thing out. You know, we're sitting in place, and it became a bestseller genuinely after that. But the whole progression of this thing. So, now in America, this is, and then the further lesson that all of my listeners learned was the way it was reported in the press. It says things like, "Disc jockey sells non-existent book to listeners." Exactly the reverse. The listeners sold a non-existent book to the world. It was a very, and they went on. You know, they didn't want to admit.
They haven't had. Yeah.
Well, no, not that they got took. That the thing was a comment on the entire structure of the official critic, the official layer down of the 8 best dressed people. Newspapers go for this kind of stuff. The 10 bestseller books. They're the final.
Still happens today, though.
Yeah. It still does. Joe, it never changed. Excuse me. No, don't go into that. We know that it still goes today. But I'm saying this is why it was never reported and analyzed for what it really was, except overseas. That the British press loved this. And just a few years ago, that story, which you don't even remember, interestingly enough, it's been forgotten in America. But all over the world, it is recognized as a real comment on the public relations world, the world of the glib newspaper writer, the whole thing of the official lists. And the Daily Express of London a few years ago picked the 50 greatest hoaxes of the 20th century up to that time, which was 1962 or 63. And I Libertine, they gave it a great big spread. It was one of the great hoaxes of all time. So it wasn't just a little gag that it had overseas. Now, many times we've heard the story of somebody who creates a non-existent thing and gets little plugs in the paper and all that. But that's not what we did. This was very different. And when your book is banned, That's something else.
That's reviewed. It's
yeah, and by the way, if all this is documented, Time Magazine did a big story.
I remember the whole thing.
Newsweek did a big story in Life. This was all afterwards, you know, on the actual story. But none of them really touched on the meaning of the story because that was still too early. If this thing had happened today, I think people are much more aware. Even the writers, and they would make the moral of this thing, but the moral was never mentioned in any of the pieces except in the Wall Street Journal.
And outside the country.
Yeah, and outside the country, but it was a fantastic story.
It's a great story.
And I think a lot of people who are involved in it, I'm talking about listeners and so on, who are involved during that whole progression of events, never were the same in their lives after that. They never could seriously sit and watch the Academy Awards. Or even polls. You know, they read the Harris poll. It says, Charlie Brown leads Fred Appelrod by 0.2%. These things like you pick up TV Guide and it says Ed Sullivan has 37.9 units.
Yeah, sure. Right.
That it shook everybody. Only in America, by the way, do we place such importance on these abstract numbers as to whether Bonanza is 0.2% higher than the Smothers Brothers.
Not only that, numbers right through government. You remember that book 10, 15 years ago, How to Lie with Statistics?
Yeah. Well, people aren't lying. They're just totally fallacious. They don't. It's not a matter of lying.
And now back with our guest. Sanford Teller is with us. Mr. Teller is a public relations consultant. And we have Robert Kochner, who's managing editor of Newspaper Enterprise Association, and Dick Raskin, who is a college student and also a pretty good man on guitar. And we have Gene Shepherd, who is a well-known broadcaster, an actor, and an author. And in fact, his book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, which was published by Doubleday, is now in softcover, paperback edition.
John, by the way, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm going to go back into... You remember I did Voice of the Turtle, you recall seeing?
Yes, sure, I was there.
I'm going to go back into the theater more this coming year. I've got all kinds of plans, and several people have been talking to me about it. I haven't had time since I've been doing all this writing, you know. That's why I really kind of put down my acting career. But I love acting. I enjoy it tremendously. And I'm going to do some stuff this coming fall.
Mm-hmm. Something in particular that you want to mention now?
I can't yet. I can't say anything yet. Just suffice it to say, John, I'm sharpening up my tap dancing.
Very good.
Busby Berkeley back again.
Yes. You doing Off to Buffalo, a break?
Oh, no. Hello? This is more interpretive dance.
Oh, pardon me. Pardon me, Mr.
Purple
Shepherd.
Lights and the tights.
Thank
and
you,
all
Mr. Shepherd.
You're not going to be in the Martha Graham Company, are you?
No.
He's not allowed to divulge at the moment what he is going to be doing. This is a secret. You know, Dick Raskin was a listener of yours and a fan of yours when he was going to high school. And, of course, then he went out to the coast for a while, and he just came back, and he got hooked recently listening to you again. When did you first start to listen?
Must have been in 19...
Can you get a little closer there, Dick?
In 59, when you were first on... When you were on before Long John was on.
Yeah. Well, that was later when John took over the all-night trick on WOR.
I took it over in 56.
Yeah, my show, I had a show from 11:15 till midnight.
Till midnight.
Yeah.
That was the one. I used to get scared to death. He did the end of the world one night, I think.
Yeah.
Scared to death.
Well, I did the real end of the world, the way it really would be, as opposed to the science fiction way. I said, can you imagine?
What is the difference?
Well, there's a big difference because it seems to be very innocent when you read it in... And kind of exciting when you read it in science fiction. But I did a show one night based on, can you imagine what would happen if the world really was ending? And you were there. and I reproduced it.
You know, it's funny, you know, you talk about going back into acting again.
Yeah.
When I came out here, the theater in New York can't be beat. I mean, there's no place in the world. Because I love theater. I was raised in New York. And to go to Broadway and see a good show, you know, not necessarily because the critics...
And have your choice
show.
Of all kinds of things to do.
You this don't is... see many good shows nowadays, though, do you? On Broadway or off Broadway? I don't... You see, the theater in New York, I'm wondering if
it's really the place where things are happening in the theater.
Well, Bob, they've always said that about New York theater, though. You know, it's funny. If you go back to the 1890s, you read editorials saying the theater is dying. And in any given year...
Oh, yes, you hear that again and again. But I'm just wondering if there's something... I've never said the theater is dying in New York. I don't know if I'm prepared to, but I've seen theaters outside the city, repertory companies, for example. What's his name? The one in, I think, in Milwaukee is one.
Guthrie.
Or the Washington, Guthrie Theater. And the Washington
Well, Bob, maybe it's a matter of definition. I think the New York theater isn't really theater. It's showbiz. This is a very different thing. What David Merrick is doing is really... we have to make that differentiation between theater and showbiz. And New York is... After all, millions ride on shows in New York, and they don't in Milwaukee. And I'm certainly not condoning the showbiz mystique in New York, but it is showbiz. And when you bring a show in that costs $297,000 just to get on a stage... you're not as much concerned with art as you are with box office because you have a lot of people to answer.
Why is it then that so many of these $297,000 shows fail in the first few days?
Well, because they're not good. Because, you see, this even if they only pay $24 to put the show on, they might fail. Money is no criterion of it, but this is a big roulette wheel here in New York, and showbiz really has taken over much greater in 1968 than it was, say, prevalent in 1958, we'll say, because costs have gone up. And that no longer is there such a thing as the little show. It's impossible. So you take even if you see a show on Broadway that there's only two characters, these two characters are drawing down very heavy cash. The rent on the theater, the whole thing. So there's no such thing as bringing in a show for $23,000.
Not on Broadway itself.
Not on Broadway. Sure, we're talking about Broadway.
We just changed the subject here because of a telegram that came in. Long John, this is from an old friend, by the way, of the show, a name that Shep will remember. Long John, Shep is also a beautiful draftsman. Would appreciate some of his comments on the current art scene, and sign Arnold Berger.
Oh, thank you, Arnold.
Arnold, the great artist.
He's referring to the fact that one of my activities, I'm a line, I hesitate to use the word artist because I've already used that, but I do line drawings, and I've done stuff for The Voice and for Doubleday. And Arnold's a fine sculptor, by
tremendous,
the way.
Yeah.
Excellent. And, Arnold, I can say what art scene.
Let me ask you what you would comment about Andy Warhol, for example.
Oh, well, I don't think... Let's not confuse popularity with art.
No, in other words, Warhol today is commercial. I'm not saying it's art. Are you saying it's not art?
Well, there's that age-old argument as what constitutes art. And like a lot of other words in our language, the word art has gone through a rapid transition in maybe 10 years. And today, the word art, people use it to even describe insurance selling. They'll call it the art of salesmanship.
Right, you're right. Art of love.
Yeah, everything is an art today.
Yeah.
So when you talk about Warhol, you have to say Warhol is also a product of this time, that anything is art if you want to call it that. And if enough people say it is, then for them, briefly, for that time, it is.
Right.
But I say that this stuff is as trans... Because you look at a Warhol today. Warhol is strangely old-fashioned. Warhol...
You mean the old soup cans.
No, I don't mean his content. I mean the concept. Warhol is as out of date, believe me, as September Morn.
Somebody else said that about it.
Well, it's true.
On the show, too.
That's the thing with pop culture.
Oh.
See, pop culture is transitory culture. It has no genuine base. It's transitory.
Mm.
It's like a pop song. I often wonder, you know, you hear all these hit records, and everybody says, you know, they're all going out. I wonder what a pop record fan does with last year's records. Some people must have 227,000 records that they never conceivably play.
How would you classify the Beatles in all of this? Is there any kind of lasting power to the Beatles? The kind of records that you might have 5 years from now and play 5 years from now?
Personally, I don't think so.
Yeah.
see, we're making a great today pop, the word pop, and I'm in a pop medium, and incidentally, right. I know Marshall McLuhan has written about my show, so I'm in that world. And I think today we're getting very self-conscious about pop art. Mm-hmm. And so the most popular of the pop art is always considered great art, hence forever. Hence, it's supposed to have great lasting value. Well, this is kind of sad.
But, you know, on the other hand, it would seem that not until recently did people actually seriously look at the pop culture. I don't know whether...
Yeah, but that still doesn't make it any the less or any the more transitory. I've noticed that you take people like the Beatles and so on. I noticed that their earlier records are never played.
That's
which
right.
means then that their art really, even within their own milieu, is transitory.
Of course, the other thing is, the other explanation is, well, now they've developed into art, you see, which they had their origins 5 years ago. Now it is art.
Well, now you're
too.
Saying then that what they're cutting now, you will hear 10 years
I'm
from
not
now.
Saying that.
Well,
I'm
that
not
remains
saying
to
that.
Be seen.
Yeah.
See,
well,
at any given time, I
others
remember,
say that, yeah.
Look, I've had this same argument over and over again, Sandy, with people, and I keep saying to them, you know, there's no way for you to know. I remember one time having an argument with somebody in a radio station about Bill Haley.
Yeah.
And everybody said, well, you know, this is such a fantastically popular thing. It's really going to go on and on. Well, whoever hears of Bill Haley today?